Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell. I'm here with Bridget Delaney to talk about her new book, Wellmania. Welcome, Bridget.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
Now, it's a very bright and yellow cover, a gorgeous book. It's going to stand out in bookshops. It has a woman doing yoga on the front. So I opened it in one mood, I have to admit. I opened it in a particular mood, going, this is going to be light and fluffy. And I got to the first page and went, wow! Like, it was a completely different impression. I mean, I see so many books in the role that I have that I have this terrible affliction of judging book by its cover. But getting into that first couple of pages, this is a completely different book, and I'm so happy that this is the book that it is. It's honest. Writing is terrifying for most people anyway, but being so honest about yourself and your experiences, is this the way that you thought the book was going to go, or is this just how it rolled out?
It's how it rolled out. I don't think it's worthwhile writing anything that's not completely honest, because the reader can smell inauthenticity a mile off. So if you're going to write, and if someone's going to read it, then just give them the truth. And
but there isn't that's what a selective, I've done. There's a selective truth that writers can use in those circumstances?
There can be, but I can always tell when I read a book where the writer's held back, and I don't like that. Mm. You know, I think if you're going to go to the trouble of writing a book, then let everything out.
Okay, so I was drawn straight into it because of that. There's an authenticity in this book. I mean, I've loved your writing in The Guardian. I've always read your writing there, and I found that voice comes through. I suppose I just set on the wrong direction because of the brightness of the cover. I think I got given the wrong impression. And anyone who's read your writing in The Guardian or the other books that you've written will appreciate immediately when they pick up this book that they're going to be taken on a ride. That is dark, but darkly funny, honest, and balanced. So there's a nice balance there, because you are looking at the kind of the healthy different modes that are going on at the moment. You start off with fasting. That seems like a daunting prospect. How did you agree, or why did you agree to that as a starting point?
Well, I guess this brings us to the start of the book, which was I was living in America. I was in New York. And I'd had way too many burgers, way too much booze. I was feeling incredibly unhealthy. It was winter. I put on weight, and I get an email from one of my editors back in Australia saying that they were interested in someone trying out an extreme fast that Malcolm Turnbull had done a couple of years ago, and would I like to do it? So immediately I thought, well, look, I need to do it. Whether I'd like to do it is another question. But I agreed to do it, and I came back to Australia feeling quite sluggish and a bit gross, and had a big night before I started on the fast, went out really late, was quite hungover, and then embarked upon this 101-day fast, which involved 2 weeks of absolutely no food. And that was, it almost killed me, literally. But I stuck with it, and the experiences of that fast are detailed quite, quite extensively in the book.
Well, do you also, because there's the methodology and the theology or the mythology around the fasting, the doctor who runs it, the Chinese doctor who runs it, and their reasons, and then you start, it sounds like almost to kill the time while waiting for the 2 weeks to end. Researching other fasting places and looking for any help whatsoever to get you through the day. And there's that side of it, so it's sort of the woo-woo sort of side of things. Then you sort of give us a more scientific approach. What mind won that battle while you were in that fasting mode? Do you have your little scientific mind telling you, or your woo-woo mind? Like, because you go into it wholeheartedly.
I do. I was open to both the science and also the true believers. So there's whole communities of people that fast, and they believe all sorts of things, like when you start to smell after not eating, it's the toxins leaving the body, or when you have various aches and pains, they're sites of old injuries that are being healed through the fast. Whereas the science community will say, when you starve yourself, your body is leached of various vital nutrients, and your body is in pain and, you know, desperate for those nutrients. So what one side says is a healing crisis, the other side says is you better start eating or you're going to be in trouble. So I had both those voices in my head, but I did kind of more go on the alternative route when I was fasting, because I was doing alternative medicine, so I had to kind of keep the faith.
Hmm. And this led on to, I mean, this was for an article, and now you've got a book. How did that happen?
Well, because I was so bored when I was fasting, I had very little energy. I didn't go out. I had no social life. I had no meals to keep me occupied. I wasn't shopping or doing anything. So I kept a very extensive diary. And in fact, all the book is you know, draws heavily on diaries that I've kept over the years. But I kept a long diary on my moods when I was fasting, how I was feeling physically, people's response to how I was beginning to look. I started to look quite different. And then it came time to do the article, and they only wanted 800 words. And I was so cross, because I'd done this vast... this vast kind of explanation that ran to, 100,000 words, and I had to use 800. So I always knew that there'd probably be a book, or at least a big chapter of a book in that experience.
And so what did you roll on to next? So you've gone, the fasting is one aspect of it.
Yep. Before, the book's divided into three parts: lean, mean, and... I know, lean, not mean. Lean, clean, and I felt mean when I was not eating. Lean, clean, and serene. So the serene bit is looking for inner peace, and it's a lot of meditation, retreats, various New Age and Eastern kind of therapies. And I started researching that in 2005. I became really interested in spirituality, different types of spirituality, and whether it was possible by going into a monastery or going on a silent retreat or meditating, if I could find inner peace. And so that search has been a really long one that I go into in the serene section. And that, I think, will be something that I'll continue for the rest of my life. Like I didn't necessarily find a magic bullet, but I loved the process of meeting... I met a lot of teachers in that period of time who, devote their life trying to make people feel a sense of inner peace and calm. And I met these people all over the world. So that part of the book details, 12 years of I guess, spiritual seeking. Some of it is, with gurus that were terrible and, made quite humorous tales. And other people were a bit more sort of sensible. And then the other part of the book, which I wrote last year during the kind of Australian election campaign and Trump and all the kind of negativity that was happening last year, I decided to do a modern yogi course where they promised that in 6 weeks, if you do yoga every day for 90 minutes and meditate and go to these Monday night classes, you'll have some sort of transformation. So the middle section of the book is looking at the cult of yoga in our society, particularly I was living in Bondi at the time, and it's massive there. And so I look at how that aesthetic of like very expensive gym gear and yoga pants have become the default uniform for a lot of people. And I explore like, why is that the case? Is it because there's a big God-shaped hole in our lives, or is it because... people aren't getting any wisdom from other aspects of their life, so they go to yoga to get, what I call the nuggets of truth, like the little sermon at the end of the class. So, yeah, so it's something that I think a lot of people will be able to relate to.
What I think is relatable is who's taking us in.
Mm.
Like, because the way in which you described the night before the fast, I don't know if this is giving too much away, but the way you came into here today with your story about how you're living your life right now, we're seeing someone who is not transformed, not taken up to heaven on a cloud of transform my life, I'm now absolutely perfect. But someone who's willing to try and to test things and to see what works. They've done all these things. Are you taking, like a supermarket choice, I'll take a bit of that and a bit of this and a bit of that. Is there something that packages that you got out of this that are working for you, that you've sort of clumped together and it's now your little religion yourself?
Meditation, definitely. You know, it's a thing that I think works, and I do it each day, or I try and do it each day. But look, I'm a massive hedonist, and I'm like a lot of people. I love going out. I drink. I don't smoke. I might have like 2 cigarettes a year, but you know, I have late nights. I like fried chicken. So it's like, how do you have some of that and not keel over? And also, how do you incorporate the good stuff, like the juices and the exercise, but not become a total bore and have, you know, nothing to look forward to? And what I've found when stepping back and really looking at my own life and how I approach these things and how other people do it is that we're not given much guidance. Like, where there's, you know, a lot of options for socializing and drinking, and there's a lot of pressure to go out and have fun. And I've just come back from a 8-day music festival down in Tasmania, and there was just alcohol everywhere. And it's very hard to, you know, completely say no to it. But what are the things that you can do that can sort of lessen the effects or make you feel healthy? And, you know, so I think exercising every day is really important. So I had a very late night last night, but I've just come from an hour's yoga class. So I'm not there yet. I'm, you know, I wish I was Gwyneth Paltrow some days, but I'm not. I'm just an ordinary person trying to make it all work.
Is that sense of I'm not there yet? I mean, the world mania, the kind of sense that you have to do these things that's kind of affecting all of us. We're all sort of getting caught up in it. Every 5 minutes there's another way to whatever the perfection thing is, and we all turn our heads and we all start walking in that direction, and then someone else will shout over from a different direction, "No, this is the way," and we all wander off that way. It creates a lot of anxiety.
Certainly
about,
does.
About who you are and what works and what you want out of things. And it's, I feel at the moment we're in a kind of a washing machine with all these ideas, and we're just getting moved around. I understand why you're sort of going for the meditation side of things. It does feel like it's a bit much right now. And all the different people who are there ready to hand out solutions, it just seems to be too many solutions.
And are the solutions the right solutions? So for some people, quitting sugar is great and it works. For other people, it's not sustainable and their bodies need some form of sugar. Paleo is great for some people, not for others. But I don't blame people for being confused, because there are these very powerful celebrities who have a very big voice in the media who are pushing products or diets, whether that be like someone like Michelle Bridges or Pete Evans or Sarah Wilson. There are people who say this way is the way that works for me. And so I know people that have done all 3 programs in 1 year, and, you know, none of those programs have worked for them because it hasn't been sustainable with their lifestyles. So what do you do? I don't know. It's probably the answer is moderation in all forms. But that doesn't seem to be selling.
No, well, Epicurus, the Greek philosopher, his whole thing was moderation, and he's come down in history as the guy, the Epicurean, the word Epicurean, instead of food and wine, you know, the poor bastard.
Yeah, well, that's another thing I noticed when I was researching the book, is that we're in Australia has a massive food culture, you know, it's food festivals, you know, sort of amazing cafes, these sort of, you know, gourmet things that are on, that, you know, you're encouraged to have degustation or to sit down and, you know, to travel around and sample all these incredible meals. Yet on the other side, we're also told that we shouldn't be eating carbs or we shouldn't be eating sugar. So there's tension within our society between enjoying this amazing food that we've got and yet also restricting ourselves. And yeah, you're right, people are in this washing machine of confusion.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that you've sort of touched on it, that we're in an era of Trump and Brexit and terrorism and hysteria on TV and the like. That can't be good for people who are trying to find inner peace.
Mm. Well, the question that I ask myself in this book is, are we in danger of withdrawing completely? So, you know, there's a lot of bad news around. And so something like a yoga practice can bring, or a spiritual practice can bring you into yourself and can quieten you. But should there come a time when we actually need to be more vocal or politically engaged or more socially active, how do these practices fit with social responsibility?
Mm.
So one of the issues I've had with certain meditation teachers is they say just yield to your breath, yield to the moment, don't push anything, go with the flow. And my question to them is, well, what if you see injustice, or what if you see you know, something that needs changing? How does that go with the flow philosophy fit with the need to be politically active at a time when, you know, people's rights might be being taken away? So that's, I think, yeah, it's not a heavy part of the book, but it's questions that I ask in the book, as well as, you know, is it wrong to not eat anything for 16 days? You know, so yeah, it's a bit of how are we living now.
Was that to me, because I've sort of drifted in and out of friendships with people who have either found inner peace or have got some sort of belief system. And I've always felt that aspect of it, where they are withdrawing from society and the wrongs in society, and they're losing their voice and they're not angry.
Mm.
Like I like anger. And there's a lot to be angry about, so we should actually use it to change stuff and look after others. There's a sort of a selfishness which I don't like. I certainly don't like it when I deal with people who are constantly worrying about food, health, and the spirit and that sort of side of it. I think of it as a turning away, as a rejection. It's not my problem. I don't want to deal with all that stuff. I've always been one to sort of think of more active engagement rather than moving withdrawal.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had exactly the same tension in my life when I've been trying to engage with practices that encourage a lot of inwardness. And I think part of that's growing up in a, you know, Catholic household where it's social justice, it's that social justice Catholic thing. But the teachers that I've spoken to have said, if you are peaceful within yourself, you're less likely to cause harm to others, and therefore you're creating a more peaceful world by being peaceful. I'm not quite sure. I can see the logic in that, but I'm not quite sure that that's something that we need right now. So it's one of those situations where, you know, young people seem to be getting more politically active. So this time next year we could, you know, anything could happen. But the New York Times did a really interesting piece on, I guess, older women, so say women in their 30s, 40s, beyond, who were into yoga, and how that a lot of those women were retreating from the political sphere and were very focused on a yoga practice or their domestic life. And they pinpointed that as a kind of a lost generation, so a generation of women that had decided it's too difficult to be politically active, but yet they can control the in and out of their own breath.
We don't see it as much here because we have compulsory voting. I think you saw what happened in France the other day, and in England as well, in Britain, the turnout for voting. Thankfully, this time more young people turned out to vote in Britain, but there's this kind of disengagement thing, which works really well for the wrong people.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, hence Brexit.
So you've come out, you've written this book, you've had time to think about it, and you're now going out there and talking about it to people like me. What are the things that, having done this, that you're taking with you that you'll go, thank you, book, you gave me insight into this, or you gave me a better understanding of, of me or in some way. Is there anything you've won, you've earned from this book?
I think there's a great pleasure in being able to take stock of your experiences and to also assess your experiences. So for 12 years, I've traveled around the world doing all these crazy things, sometimes for stories, sometimes just for my own curiosity. And the chance to kind of put all of that into a narrative, to give it some shape, I think it's a great privilege. Like, most people don't get the luxury of stepping back and shaping their own life or a portion of their life. So the book's allowed me to kind of, it's almost like sweeping up all these sort of scraps of bits and bobs on the ground and, you know, raking the leaves of experience, and it's now in a nice pile. And also just to be able to share the experiences. You know, I've been very lucky to have been able to do the things I've done. So, yeah, I'm really happy to kind of talk about them and share them.
Do you keep the diary still, or do you...?
Yeah, I do keep a diary. I'm starting to get a bit bored now with, like, oh, shouldn't have had that fourth coffee, you know, like writing stuff that's a bit dull. But no, I have kept a diary since I was 20. So it's good to go back and look at how you can make the same mistakes over and over again.
I get so jealous of people who keep diaries. I got very lucky and got to speak to Michael Palin, and he was the diary keeper amongst that group. So they all come to him when they're writing their memoirs, because he's got the dates, he's got everything down. And he'd go back and look at his own life, and he saw him, he published all his diaries. And when Peter Garrett was writing his memoir, there's one guy in the band that was a diary keeper, and so they all go back to him and say, what the hell were we doing? And what happened? And this guy was nicely writing it all down. It seems to me that there's a similar thing, because I get to meet writers all the time, and so many writers don't keep diaries, and I think that's a strange thing. But there's a similarity between the people who do, and in their way, and the stuff that you recall here has a ring of truth to it that comes from that immediacy, I suppose. And how much do you put in? Like, is it 500 words? Is it 200 words, or is it just a sketch?
So often when I've gone away, for example, on retreat, it's been a contemplative time where I haven't been socializing a lot. So I've written reams and reams about my experiences in various places, or when I'm traveling on a train or on a plane. They're kind of more hedonistic stuff when I've gone through sort of big partying jags where I've had like lots of late nights. Often they're shorter entries, and I then have a second lot of diaries, which is date diaries. So I use them as well. So often I'll go back to them and I'll say, oh my gosh, I've been out 24 nights in a row. And I've been to all these different restaurants. And one of my jobs for The Guardian was reviewing. And I talk a lot about, like, the, you know, going to so many restaurants and reviewing them that my pants split. And, you know, so that sort of stuff is in a couple of places, and you know, I'm glad to have written it down, because it does make writing the book a bit easier.
But is this something that on your deathbed you'll go, darling, burn the diaries?
Like Helen Garner. Yeah.
Or are you going to let them be a historical record?
Well, firstly, I don't think anyone's interested enough in reading them. Some of them have been in my parents' garage for years.
I think that's what peeps said. I think if anyone's interested in reading my diaries, I'll burn those.
But my parents have had them for years, and I just assumed they'd be curious enough about my inner life to read them. And, you know, they're like, oh, when are you going to take away those old books from our garage? And they, of course, they didn't look at them. You know, it is a lot of stuff in diaries is self-indulgent and, you know, ridiculous, and so I don't think, unless Wellmania is a massive hit, and then there's historical curiosity about me, I think I'm okay.
Thank you very much for coming in and speaking about Wellmania.
That was great. Thank you. Thank you for supporting this.
You can get Wellmania on booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.